Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. Today, we're really fortunate. We have the co-founder and CEO of Track.ai, Adam Rubenstein, with us. Adam, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me here. I'm really excited to be on the podcast.
Our pleasure. And so, why don't we start with Track.ai? What problem is it solving in the marketplace?
I'm going to step back. I'm a serial entrepreneur. You always start by selling something. And it sounds really simple, but it's probably the hardest thing there is to do. And you start selling and you build a company, or you're trying to build a company, and you get to a point where you've got a board of directors, and the board flies in every quarter for a meeting, and they sit down. The first question they ask is, Adam, are you going to hit your numbers? And sometimes I get to say yes, and sometimes I have to say no. And the next question is, what are you going to do about it? And that was the problem that I dealt with for the past 20 years. How do you ensure that you're going to hit your numbers? And the problem is, in sales, unlike almost any other part of the company, has been, it's not data driven. It's all been kind of subjective and gut and intuition. And so how do you make your team better? And so it was about making a sales organization perform better. In my last company, I had 125 salespeople toward the end, and I have no idea what they're doing. I don't know who's doing what well, who's doing poorly, who needs help. And even if I did, I did not know necessarily how to coach them, how to make them better. And Track is designed to solve that problem. So I sold that company. I saw the problem. I like to solve problems. And I said, how do we solve it? We use AI, conversational intelligence, and we put the two together and we make sales teams better.
Well, you hit a whole host of follow-on questions that I was going to have. But if we can unpack how conversational AI is making sales teams better, please.
Sure. So there's a lot of different degrees of assistance. You know, there are tools out there you can record a sales conversation or any conversation. Now you have a recording, which means that you can go back and refer to it. And 15 years ago, I used to have one of those little handheld pocket recorders, and I'd put my phone on speaker and I would record calls, thinking I was going to go back, knowing that if somebody asked me a question about that conversation, at least I'd have something I could refer back to it. Well, it wasn't who has time to go back to those conversations, but it was the impetus for kind of figuring out how to do it better. And today it's, if you record the conversation, you have something to refer to, you can go back, you can listen to the tone of voice if you need to, but you can see kind of what did people say and what were their concerns. You know, I'm a big believer that if you ask smart questions during a sales conversation, people will tell you everything you need to know to win their business. Doesn't mean you're going to win it, because you may not be able to satisfy their needs, but at least you'll know what they're looking for, which is, you know, half the battle is understanding the problem. And so we now are able to record the conversation, and then we, you know, kind of mine it or analyze it for insights, things that me as a salesperson, I've got my own biases and I hear what I want to hear, but AI hears everything. It hears the positives and the subtle negatives, you know, things that might come across as an objection, but maybe my brain didn't hear it. So we can kind of analyze the sales opportunity for deal strategy. And then there's the coaching side of it, you know, evaluating the call for the team's performance. Did they build rapport? Did they ask thoughtful questions? Were they open-ended questions? Did they give their prospect time to respond? Did they respond thoughtfully to it? All these things can be evaluated and measured and scored, so we can generate a score after every call. And so I always tell people, you know, sales is a sport. Did you play any sports
growing up? I was not super coordinated, so I was doing coordinated. I was doing cross country and track. Not to say there aren't coordinated people doing those sports, but I was kind of regulated to them.
Okay, but you have a coach, right? And the coach is guiding you. They look at your performance. Well, sales is one of those sports where you only learn kind of at the end of the game whether you're performing well, right? So, you know, in my old job, people come knock on the door and they'd come in and they'd, you know, be excited to tell me they just won a deal, but more often than not, it was they lost a deal. And, you know, how do you help them get past that? Well, and you don't want to learn at the end. I mean, like, you know, it's imagine if we all played basketball and we only heard how the game went at the end of the game. You want halftime. You want to be able to see what things are going on. And so by having salespeople review their conversations, I liken it to reviewing game film. Right after a conversation, they can see their performance, where they can improve. And it's funny, all of our clients, there's one metric that we use. It's building a sense of urgency. And it is probably the most challenging thing to accomplish in a sales conversation. How do you get, it's the way to make people move more quickly. It's a way to shorten sales cycles, but it's really hard to do. And I have clients call me up and they'll say, Adam, I am so struggling with building a sense of urgency. I keep getting a six on that when I'm getting eights, nines, and tens on everything else. But it's that kind of feedback. And, you know, look, even LeBron James goes to practice every day and he gets coached. Even the best salespeople need continuous coaching. And it's that continuous coaching that, you know, okay, today I forgot to really build rapport. I was too short with the client or prospect, but I'll remember that. And maybe tomorrow I'll make a mistake somewhere else, but you're kind of slowly getting better over time. And that's what that self-guided coaching is so helpful for. So that's one aspect of how you can use these call recordings. The other is client retention. So we had clients come to us and they said, you know, the worst thing you hear is you're dealing with a client and they're disgruntled. They're maybe a little bit upset. The account manager either doesn't hear it or they choose to ignore it. And the next thing you know, you're getting a cancellation letter. How do we use AI to measure their satisfaction? And so we built that into the technology. So after every account management or sale, you know, customer success call, we will evaluate whether they are pleased, neutral, or displeased, and we will score it. And then that can be shared so that you know who may, you know, let's jump in on those problem calls and solve them or, you know, do our best to mitigate the problem before it's too late. So these are some of the things that we're able to do by recording and analyzing calls with AI.
So, wow. All right. So let me share back what I heard is that there are formulas. Mm-hmm. Depending on the use case, whether you're, you know, seeking to match a potential client with your solution or making sure that you're delivering quality that results in client satisfaction. And you've created a combination of an intra-cycle feedback loop. Mm-hmm. And I love the analogy, watching film, brilliant. But then also kind of a real-time net promoter score. So in either scenario, you don't find out when it's too late, you haven't achieved the outcome, that you're looking for.
Exactly. And that's, all of us have this problem and we'll take it a step further. A lot of sales leadership are great salespeople that have moved up through the organization. I mean, we used to make this mistake. We'd like, oh, you're a great sales guy. Would you like to be managing our sales team? And, you know, some said yes, some didn't want that role. But if they said yes, the problem is they may be great salespeople, which are often, they have this intuitive, natural instinct for sales, but they don't know how to teach sales, mm-hmm. right? And so what they often do, our company did this, you go and hire some guru to come in for 3 days for a lot of money, and they're teaching a very generic form of sales, you know, a sales approach or sales improvement. And for about 3 weeks, everyone's excited, morale is way up. But when that ends after 3 weeks, kind of things revert back to their prior behavior. Sure. And so that's this coaching and building. We have, you know, a coaching library where you can put your best performances in there. These are things that salespeople need, and they need to hear it from the best. You want them mimicking the best, and you want to be doing that as frequently as possible because coaching has to be a continuous loop.
Yeah. So, you know, two thoughts jump out. Yes, I agree with you. Just because you're a great player doesn't mean you make a great coach.
Right.
And two, you know, practice is not make perfect. Practice right. makes permanent. Perfect yeah. practice makes
perfect.
So I have a question without revealing any trade secrets. I have a question about the formula. Before you shed some insight into it, I think probably more appropriate if you can share your background. And, so I heard prior company, if you can kind of walk us through the career progression leading up to Track AI, I know our audience would love to hear it.
Sure. I won't go back to the very beginning, but first company we got involved, if you're familiar with the prepaid calling card industry, and you're familiar with it.
Dating myself too,
Yes. It was quite a while ago, prior to cell phones becoming so ubiquitous, and got into that industry and sold that business to another company that got sold again. We did well with that. Didn't know what to do next. Started a little consulting firm trying to help companies really around the dot-com boom. Did some consulting. Got into for a very brief period of time when everybody was building these companies. I think one was plastics.com. They were trying to kind of assemble all the manufacturing companies that were dot-coms, and we were involved. And we had a company called MetalClick, which was buying and selling scrap metal, and built it up. We didn't build it. We actually designed it. And before we'd even built or written our first line of code, somebody came along and they spent $1.5 million to buy a concept, which was, that's great. But that was that dot-com boom that, quickly, exploded, imploded, maybe is a better word. Then next company, the one more recently, MotionPoint, one of my colleagues, CTO, and I developed a lot of technologies, got a lot of patents for it, on converting websites into other languages and doing it in such a way that it was a lot of automation. It was humans doing the translating, but we're able to convert websites like a HomeDepot.com into Spanish in a matter of a month, that type of speed. And it worked beautifully, built that up. And that was the one we sold it in 2021.
Congrats.
And that was a great long run. And I thought, okay, what am I going to do next? And I recall my biggest problems with all those prior companies was sales, right? How do you make the sales team better? How do you improve their performance? And so, after about a couple months of kind of sitting around trying to think what to do next, we came up with Track.ai.
So it's an exciting career. And so a couple questions. Out of curiosity, the consulting stint, was that kind of out of necessity, or did you have an opinion that that would just be kind of a good, I don't know, holding pattern is the right description, just a good way to figure out what you were going to do next?
I think it was more of a holding pattern. I had a professor once say that, when you got to get in the building and see all the halls and doorways before you have to see which doorway to go through, you got to put yourself in an environment to see opportunity. And it was actually that consulting that led us to the MetalClick deal,
Okay.
right? So yes, it was a holding pattern trying to figure out what to do next.
And I think that's great insight because I often, when I put my mentor hat on, I often get the question, hey, I don't know what to do. And I've kind of come to the conclusion that, action creates opportunity. And even if you don't, if it's not clear what action you should take, put yourself out there.
Right.
A consultant's a great way to do it because the cost of capital is next to zero. I mean, effectively, it's your time, but you're not having to incur a whole host of expenses
Right.
to bring the bring your consulting business to life. So
Yes, I
great,
completely
great.
agree.
Okay, so if we come back to Track, and forgive me if I don't know if you said you may have, if not, someone said we're all in sales,
Right.
and so and I agree with. Your assessment. I mean, my opinion is, most for-profit businesses, they all go out of business the same reason, they run out of cash. Generally speaking, notwithstanding how you're managing your expenses, I mean, you got to focus on top line. So, what was the process by which you realize what this formula is that you subsequently coded? For purposes of making the two assessments that we talked about.
Well, the first thing we did when we started out, I found two partners. I'm not a technical person. I found two technical partners. The three of us got together, and I had this kind of idea, a concept. And so we started kind of working it through, talking about what we want to accomplish. We knew it was going to be sales related. We knew it was going to be about helping sales teams. We had not defined, certainly this was before AI. When we decided to do AI, we had to build our own. I mean, it was way before November of 2022 when ChatGPT kind of unveiled itself. And that was painful, building your own AI. So we knew that, but then I reached out to a lot of people through LinkedIn and I started having interview calls and I would, you know, basically say, if we had a way to do this, what do you think of that? And they would tell me, well, that would be helpful, but what would really be helpful if you could help me coach my team and make them better. So through feedback, I got a lot of guidance. And then we would start building things, kind of proof of concepts and share them and get more feedback. And it was slowly morphed into what it is today. But it's one thing I've learned, if you listen to clients, you can't listen to everything clients tell you because they can lead you astray. But if you lead the client, if you talk to clients and let them give you some guidance on where the big problems are, you can design something that will solve a big problem. And I think this is maybe the biggest problem in the world today, which is helping salespeople perform better. I think there's a study, maybe, I don't know who did it, but 60% of most sales teams are going to miss their number in any given year. And so, okay, big problem. Let's find a solution. And then slowly you narrow it down. There are lots of tools out there that will record conversations, but our focus was sales improvement. Anytime you're speaking with a prospect or a client, that's where we want to be. And not even every industry, we want to focus on certain industries to understand how to help them. And so some of the formula to coaching, we're dealing with some insurance companies and they're independent agencies. They may be captive, meaning they work for an Allstate, or they may be independent working for lots of different carriers, but they will have training materials. And so they'll say to me, here's how I like to train my people, but I don't have time. I've got 25 producers on my staff. Yeah. I don't have time for this. They will give us their training materials and we will build them into an analysis for their needs. So we do a lot of custom work. We don't charge for it. We know that if we build the tools they want, the product becomes very sticky. Mm-hmm. And so there is kind of our generic coaching, and then there is the industry or company specific coaching that will be used to evaluate performance.
You know, you hit on, you know, I think two really valuable insights that any founder, I think, well, definitely successful founders experience, but you know, anyone who's thinking about starting a company should take heed. And one was know your customer, you know, mm-hmm. So reaching out to people on LinkedIn, connecting with them, engaging them, brilliant. You know, I think that's key to success. You know, and then the second one is just, you know, how do you, so many people think about, oh, I'm going to create software and I'm going to have this amazing enterprise value because the market's going to value me with the software multiple, but not appreciating that you still need people. You still have to make it super simple to use your software. And in the beginning, you know what, there's a little bit of customer success and professional services that's involved,
right?
Because you got to make it easy. And so, yes. You know, calling those out, I think is really worthwhile, because I think sometimes I've talked to founders who think I have to automate everything. I said, no, that'll come, you know, get, you know, first engage and get feedback. And then you can think about how you can make this as chunky as possible.
Right. Completely agree with that. And we're, you know, there's a lot of things that we're doing on the back end that will need to be automated with time. But, you know, our focus is always pleasing the clients, right? Giving them what they want. We don't do long-term contracts. Mm-hmm. Our attitude is, I was always frustrated. I sign up with some product and the product is just not what I expected. And I try to cancel and like, nope, you're going to pay your year contract, even though you're only 6 months in. That was frustrating. So we said, we're not going to be that. We mm-hmm. are going to do month to month. And if we are not driving enough value, tenfold or 100-fold what you pay, shame on us for not building the right product. And so it has kept us kind of on our toes and always fighting to make the product that really satisfies clients. And it, you know, it does lead to clients want a lot of stuff, right? And we have a huge roadmap, but we bite it off as we, you know, chunks at a time and keep developing more and more and better value, you know, just better value for our clients. And so it's the only approach I know how to do.
Well, I think so. Let's unpack your business philosophy. You know, a subject that I find really fascinating is culture. You know, sometimes it's consequential, sometimes it's deliberate. What's your approach?
Very deliberate. When you're hiring salespeople, especially if you're hiring good salespeople, that's what I was doing in my past lives. Great salespeople, they can get a job anywhere, right? And they're also, most salespeople are really good at selling themselves. So you have to be really thoughtful and careful in hiring them. And if they are great, and in our last company, we were not paying the highest market rates. I mean, if you're willing to pay more than everybody else, you can probably get anybody you want, but we weren't going to do that. So I really promoted the culture. I said that, you know, when you come to our company, there are three things we want to accomplish. We want to do good by our stakeholders. That's our vendors, our employees, our customers, right? And investors. Make sure that we're doing the right thing for them. We believe heavily in professional growth. Like I would tell people, they're joining this company and they need to grow. They cannot be stagnant. And that could be, they could become better writers, better salespeople, better technologists. I mean, they may be salespeople, but I want them to become a better communicator. I want them to learn a little bit about technology so that they're always growing. And when they leave here, you know, in the old days, they might have a whole career of 30 years, 40 years in one company, but that's not the way of the world today. So I said, you're going to leave here and I want people to go, I want that, it was Motion Point. If we're hiring someone from Motion Point, we know they're going to be top talent. That was a goal. And finally, it was about having fun. And I don't mean like every day you're going to giggle, but I would tell people as I hired them, if for 2 weeks in a row you wake up and go, oh, I got to go to work today, come see me. We'll determine if there's somewhere else in the company that you'd be a better fit. And if not, we'll give you a month runway to find that next job that is a better fit, because nobody wants to wake up and have that dreadful feeling in the gut of their stomach, in the pit of their stomach, that they're going to the terrible job. So I think that was deliberate, and that was my kind of my overarching theme in building the culture.
It's interesting. I was having this conversation this morning with a GP of a fund, and we were talking about just ownership and how do you nurture that within an organization? And today we live in an age where things are very transparent. People have access to a whole host of information, can compare notes with colleagues. And so this idea of genuinely showing you care about someone by virtue of your action, it's really easy to tell because we have no shortage of other resources where we can say, hey, is this par for the course or not? And so let me build on that. So I find myself participating in a lot of conversations about equity for staff, and most of our clients are corporations, and so it's really straightforward for them to create a stock option and grant plan. But I find that a lot of founders have an opinion that, oh, I'm paying my sales staff commissions, so I don't need to give them as much equity. I'd love to know your opinion.
The first thing that we consider is whether they care about equity. There's a lot of people that we would offer them stock options because it seemed to make sense. I mean, we want them as vested in this enterprise as we are as the founders, because all we have is equity. We don't, you know, we barely pay. I mean, I barely pay myself now. I think I cover my health insurance, right? It's just, I don't need to pay myself more, and I don't want to waste the money on me. But a lot of people, we'd offer them stock options with grants that we thought were really significant. And they were like, well, no, but what about my salary? You know, that's all they cared about. So first thing is figuring out what somebody really cares about, right? Some people it's cash, they need cash. Now some people see they're, you know, investors, right? It's the way they treat their money today. Are they putting it in the bank? Are they just spending everything? You have to first figure that out. And then you decide, you know, what is an appropriate amount. And what I would do, or I'm not sure this is the right thing to do, but I would kind of look out and say, 5 years out, I think this is going to be worth X, right? It's $1 a share today, but it's going to be worth $10 a share then. And so I'm basically giving you $250,000 if this thing goes moderately well. We're not a unicorn, but we do, for over 5 years, that's a $50,000 raise. I mean, you know, and part of it is to, you know, feel them out and see whether that was, you know, made them excited or not. But I think that everybody should, not everybody, those that recognize the value and want to be part of this venture and be on this journey with us, they should all be vested and have equity of some sort. And so I'm a big believer. The amount, that's more challenging. And, you know, it's, I think it's got to be set proportionate to their role in the company. You know, the CTO is going to do much better than somebody who is got a very, you know, maybe the secretary or the front desk attendant, whoever he is, you know, may not have a significant role and have that much ability to change the course of the company.
We're in alignment. I've always held the opinion that compensation should be commensurate with responsibilities. You know, part of the, with, you know, as we were, our firm, we have our CFO hat on. I agree. A lot of times I find myself in conversations where people just want cash, you know. Right. I'd rather take, you know, bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. And I find sometimes, though, it's just like there's an, you know, an education gap. Like, hey, right. Capital gains are taxed at a lower rate than income. Right. You know, the way to really build wealth is through equity. Right. And so, but totally, you know, I think you're spot on. It's just at least having the conversation is really valuable.
And one piece I wanted to add with the culture, I think that having a career path, I didn't really mention it at first, but especially for salespeople, especially for, we would go out to the universities and bring in, you know, fresh grads, bring them in. But, you know, I know people, they start out as sales development reps and they're like, well, how do I get to become an AE? And where do I go from there? And so having a career path that's thoughtful, that is kind of objectively measured. It's not, oh, I like you today, so I'm going to give you. It's like we had a career path and we said, you start out as an SDR and you have to make this many calls and have this many appointments and have to have those turn into X number of deals over the next 12 months to get, become a, I don't know if we call it a junior or, you know, an AE or junior AE, something like that. So they're account executive. And then there's levels of account executive and it affected their, which deals they got and what their commission rates were. But I thought that was really important because a lot of people, like, you know, I don't want people to stagnate. I just, that bothers me that they might leave the company after 5 years and still be at the same, you know, education level and skill set they were when they got to the company.
Well, I presume it's intentional, but as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking to myself, I mean, that's totally consistent with your broader philosophy of turning sales into a game, because if you know what your milestones are, it becomes, right, becomes a lot easier for someone to say, okay, what do I got to do? You know, what are my rep schemes, my reps and sets to hit my numbers?
And it fits with a theme. You know, our tagline used to be turning the art of sales into a science, right? That type of thing, where we wanted things. I mean, right now, salespeople got measured, and we were, even before we started track, there's always this activity level, like how many leads do you have, and how many do you convert to prospects, and how many calls did you make, how many emails did you send, and that's activity measurement. And we wanted to layer on the ability to measure that more subjective, which is the sales conversation. How do you measure conversations and get real data out of them? And that's really what Track has done. So it's extended that the ability to measure sales performance from the beginning. It's the activity level all the way through the conversations that lead to sales. And at the end, you've got the revenue generator. So we're trying to complete the pipeline from start to finish, making it all data driven.
You know, Adam, as I shared with you before we started recording, I've been making a habit of just letting these conversations take their natural path. And so thank you for focusing on sales, because I love the subject. I imagine most of our audience does as well. And so, you know, I thank you for humoring me, but I want to keep going with it. So, okay. You know, earlier when we were talking about the first use case of, you know, intra-cycle feedback and creating urgency in the sales process. You know, when I hear that, I think psychology. And, you know, I've like many people, I have a ChatGPT account and I've asked, I was like, hey, I have to write a follow-up email. ChatGPT, how do I create a sense of urgency? And it was like, you know, talking to a wall. It's like, I don't really know how to do this. And so, you know, if you can, you know, shed some of your own experience and insights, it's like, what does that look like? How do you unpack, you know, the human character to, you know, to engage? And I know at the end of the day, there has to be a fit for what we're selling and what someone needs are, but you're right. I mean, there are these elements that I know exist, and I've touched on them, you know, albeit sporadically in my own career. Well, how'd you figure that out?
Well, I think that for every organization, whatever you're selling, you have to understand what's the impact of, you know, there's do nothing or do something, but not what we want you to do, and doing what we want you to do. And it's making sure that you have made that clear. I mean, I can't force you to do something. I liken, you know, in all the other positions in the company, someone is telling somebody else that they control what to do. But sales is the only part of the organization where you're trying to convince somebody you have no control over to do something, to make a decision, to move in a certain direction. And you have to understand that you kind of get in their head, and not literally get in their head, but we do insurance, right? And we have a conversation. I was looking at it, and the salesperson, it was a demo, but the salesperson was acting like a real salesperson, and his sense of urgency that he created was rated at a 5. And it said, look, he had an opportunity. The AI understood he had an opportunity because the buyer said, I have some policies, they are expiring. And what is the impact of an expiring insurance policy? Well, you do not want to be uninsured. That's terrible. So he had a chance to emphasize that, you know, you don't want to be uninsured. We need to move quickly. This is not going to be overnight. We've got to do a lot of work, and we need to get started now. So you do not have, you're thinking as a buyer that you have this date where the policies expire. You can't wait to that date to make a decision. There's a lot of front loading and work that has to be done. And that same approach has to be taken, whatever you're selling. If you are, you know, you're selling your services, right? I mean, I'm going to touch on, we spoke about this prior to this podcast, that you do fractional CFO work, right? And if we're about to do some kind of investment or something that's going to require a transition, a change of ownership, I can't get you in there that day. I've got to, you'll probably need a couple months or 6 months of prep work to get everything in alignment. But the difference in valuation, if you're not given the time to do the job well, this happened to us in our prior company, that we were very slow to get a CFO or a fractional CFO into our company. And we did do a big raise. We raised the money. And later, after this had been concluded, they came to us and said, you know, we told you should have had a CFO much earlier. You refused. You didn't want to spend the money. You thought it might be poorly timed and a bad investment. We would have valued your company 50% higher, right? Well, if somebody was selling me on fractional services and they made that point that you will, whatever you spend today will come back, you know, tenfold by investing early. That's another way of building urgency. That's for a fractional CFO. If you're, whatever you're selling, you've got to understand how to build that urgency based on what the impact is going to be if you don't do something.
I like that a lot. So, you know, I've always think in terms of return. You know, if I spend a dollar, what do I get back? But what's the consequence of not getting those dollars? And being able to articulate that clearly, you know, I think really well said, that makes complete sense.
And for people who are raising money, I mean, the hassle, raising money is hard. It's challenging in so many ways. Spending the time doing the work that a CFO could do so much better, right? It's so much easier. I mean, yeah, I can put together a pro forma and I can spend days doing it. And you can probably, you know, in your sleep, knock it out. It'll be better, you know, prepared. It'll highlight the right things that investors care about. So certainly anybody who is an entrepreneur, this is something they should be considering much earlier than they probably are. You know, we all, as entrepreneurs, all we're thinking about is, you know, building a product and generating revenue. And we completely ignore, you know, but our goal is to build a company, a significant company, and ultimately sell it, strategic sale, or to a PE firm, somebody. And yet that, you know, it's kind of like we've ignored the planning, right? We're seeing what's in front of us without looking ahead a year out and saying, where do we, if we want to be here a year out, we need this other kind of financial work performed earlier than we think.
We're in complete agreement.
Well, I assume so, but it was when I saw your company, what you do, it meant something to me because it wasn't a mistake that we made early on, and I don't want to ever make that mistake again.
Well, I think, just in terms of big picture, it's an element of you don't know what you don't know.
Right.
And so I think in anyone who's in sales, who's generally successful, can kind of flesh out the, again, to your point, what's the consequence of not going down this road and, having the ability to get feedback. I mean, look, hey, raw audience, I'm let you know right now, I'm super intrigued. And I'm probably going to go try this out in FinTrack because now I'm like really, really curious. Adam, this has been brilliant. Before we wrap up, two more questions.
Sure.
One has been my go-to for a long time. The second one is actually more recent, but I've really enjoyed asking it. So first one is, you had an opportunity to go back, have a conversation with your younger self. You pick the age. What would you share?
That's a tough question. There's so many mistakes. There are too many to enumerate. I think that being more thoughtful, I was too focused on what was right in front of me and need to be kind of projecting and thinking further out. That would be one. A life-work balance. I'm sure with your career, you've experienced this where you're torn between, okay, do I go to my kid's baseball game or do I stay at work and finish that report that the boss is demanding? That's a challenging, but that work-life balance is hard and critical. And I think it when you're very young, it's more work, and it slowly kind of changes over time. When you have family, you have kids, I would probably tell myself to have more life work balance, focus on life more, because I'd get so deep into things that I would ignore everything else. I think I try to tell my colleagues, something will happen. I'll say, look, you need to deal with that because nothing we do here at Track is more important than what you're dealing with your family, and, focus on that. And so that's, again, culture. And if you'd asked me 20 years ago, was I, serious about culture? I would have said, well, culture, nah, just go sell something, quit talking to me, go sell something. But, looking back, I think that, with perspective, you say, this actually makes for better people, better employees, better results when people are not torn between taking care of their family and taking care of work. So I'd say that culture thing, but going back and making sure I was more focused on that work-life balance and pushing culture over just getting work done.
I agree. When I'm mentoring, I point out, especially when I find myself in conversations with college students, it's like, look, you don't have kids right now. You should factor that into your planning,
right.
Because being a founder requires a tremendous amount of time, and there's only so many hours in the day.
Right.
100% agree. Last question, new question.
Okay.
I admit, I think this may be the fifth episode I've asked this, and I've really enjoyed it, but if there was someone else that you would like to see on the Innovators and Investors podcast, who would it be? Anyone.
Wow.
You want.
Anyone?
Anyone.
That's a tough question. I mean, I love the fact that you get these investors involved. The biggest challenge for entrepreneurs is meeting investors, but I wouldn't say it's a person, but people who are good at helping entrepreneurs prepare for fundraising, right? That's the type of person that I think can be very helpful. There's a lot of incubators out there, and a lot of them will do that. But for those of us who aren't in an incubator, don't attend one, getting guidance or being told where to look for help to prepare for a raise, and how do you, all the steps. I mean, it's preparing for the raise, and who should you meet, and how do you get those introductions? All that, that guidance, I think, would be tremendously helpful.
Okay. That is my mandate. I am going to make best efforts to flesh that out. on okay. future. Adam, if there are any members of our audience who want to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
Simply email's real easy, Adam, A-D-A-M, at track, T-R-A-Q, dot A-I, is the simplest way to find me.
Fantastic. Adam, thank you so much for being a guest on our podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. And again, for the benefit of our audience, Adam Rubenstein, co-founder and CEO of track.ai. Again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of FinTrap Management. This has been another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you are a successful founder or an investor who would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is at finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.